Welcome to the Layer 8 Podcast. Each episode, we'll talk tools, techniques, and stories with the experts in open source intelligence and social engineering. This episode is brought to you by Compass CyberGuard. For a quote on your pen testing or social engineering test needs, send email to info@layer8podcast.org. Now, let's get on with the show. Welcome to another episode of the Layer 8 Podcast. We're here with a incredible guest for you, a returning guest. We have Ray Baker, also known as Wondersmith Ray. Welcome, Ray.
Hey, everybody. It's good to be back.
For the benefit of our listeners, can you talk a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I am a senior open source intelligence analyst. I've been in the field since about 2019. I work on all aspects of OSINT, but the part that I like a lot is maritime OSINT. I work a lot on maritime intelligence and related OSINT fields like corporate intelligence that links into maritime intelligence. I am also a private investigator in my state. I wrote a book, which I believe we will talk about. And I am also, Espen always yells at me, I am co-founder of Case Scenarios, an immersive training for OSINT.
That sounds like you are extremely busy. I can't believe you find time to fit all of that in. That's really incredible, because you also joined us way back on episode 75 in September of 2021. If anybody missed that episode, you can also go listen to that one where we talked about Ray. And I think it was back then where you were just starting to get into some of the maritime OSINT as well. Was part of what you were digging into was that that container ship that was stuck sideways in a canal? Was it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Ever Given. I had started prior to that, but that was like the first thing that I kind of talked about live, I guess. Maritime, I feel like I fell into it because when I was starting out, I would do blogs to teach myself open source intelligence concepts, because there wasn't a whole lot of training that is affordable. And so you kind of have to teach yourself. So I would write a blog about a topic that I saw somebody mention on Twitter or LinkedIn or something that I found was interesting and I would want to learn. So the best way to learn is to get to a point where you can teach it to somebody else. And to write a blog, you really have to know what you're talking about. So that was kind of my process. I don't know what they think. If there's a name for it now, whiteboarding, I think is what they call it, where you like write it down and then you teach yourself. So I started doing that, and I would just pick random things that sounded interesting. OSINT on ICS, OSINT on IoT. And then one time I saw something on maritime and I was like, I haven't heard anything about that. So how about I write a blog on it? And I wrote a blog and people were really into it. So I wrote more and I wrote more, and then I got really, really into it. And it just kind of snowballed into this thing that I do. And I did some talks and then the Ever Given. And now it's just kind of like a thing that I focus a lot of energy on.
Yeah, I think you're probably the foremost expert, probably in the whole world, on maritime OSINT, based on
the loudest, I guess.
Now, I'll ask you a really dumb question about that type of thing. Like, what can somebody get out of maritime OSINT? Is it just a bunch of boats going around in the water in the world? Like, where is the value of that? And what types of really interesting information do you get from maritime OSINT?
Well, I guess it really depends on what you're trying to get. If you're trying to find people who are, I don't know, shipping fraudulent things or illegal things, oil transfers, things like that, you can track people. You could track movements of vessels. You could track specific vessels. You could track a fleet of vessels if you're looking at a company. So there's a lot of things you can do with maritime depending on your kind of use case. I just read an article today the Houthis, they are using maritime OSINT to target the vessels in the Red Sea. So they were using, and they didn't mention marine traffic or any specific one, but they're using a service like that to track AIS signals, which is the satellite pings from the vessel to target ships for like missile attacks and drone strikes.
So that would be certainly interesting if they were giving you credit for drone strikes.
I read the article. I was like, please don't be in there.
Please don't put my name into this. I don't want to see that at all. Put your name on a list. And I think I was listening to somebody else's podcasts recently. It might have been Darknet Diaries or one of those, where he was telling a story about how, or I guess some companies will find ways to kind of cook their books by even going as far as completely making up whether ships even exist and whether the numbers on them exist and shipments exist. I think it was like oil tankers or something.
Oh,
like
it's
that.
Most definitely oil tankers.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think the average population understands how just bizarre the ocean is and the companies and the ships that are out there. It's like the Wild West. I mean, when you get out there past like the economic zones, it's wild. People share the IMO numbers, which is the identifier for the vessel. They'll share them. They'll cover them on the side of the ship so that people taking pictures can't see it. They'll, like you said, they'll make up that ships exist, or they'll, there was a story that I add to one of my presentations where, they were flagging vessels from a country that didn't have flags. Like the IMO never gave them the ability to flag. So all of them were like fraudulently flagged, and flagging is like a whole thing. I could go into it. They do it for like convenience, like carnival cruises and stuff. They flag their vessels for tax breaks and things like that. Illicit shipments. They don't want to say they're from China, so they'll say they're Bermuda flagged. So nobody looks at them. So there's an interest in sort of hiding your identity when you're out there.
And there's probably also some interesting things going on with fishing vessels out there as well, and trying to figure out some of the things they're doing.
Yeah, and that's kind of a gray area, because fishing vessels aren't required, at least right now, to broadcast their satellite, their AIS. So there's a lot of illegal fishing where they'll either fish at the wrong times of the season, they'll go into areas they're not allowed to fish, they'll fish, you know, catches they're not allowed to catch because they're protected or whatever, and they're not very trackable. They do it at night and they're not broadcasting a signal, so nobody can track them. So there's kind of a gap in intelligence there, and people are trying to fill it with satellite imagery and RF technology and all sorts of things. You can see Global Fishing Watch. They put out all kinds of maps with like cool colored paths of how the ships track over time.
That's just amazing, this kind of stuff that's going on out there. I also really like how you described your methodology for learning something, because I think I've been similar, where one of my beliefs is to learn something, then to do it, and then to teach it. Because when you actually try to teach something to somebody, that's where you really find the gaps in your knowledge, especially if you get somebody that's going to ask you questions, because you can think that you understand something really well. But as soon as you start trying to explain it to somebody else and they ask, well, how does it work in that way? You're like, I don't know. I didn't really think about it.
I think I do it a little bit faster. So I don't teach myself first and then move to the next step. I try to do it all at one time.
You try to learn it and
yeah, learn while I'm teaching it. Yeah.
Or even just learning it and writing out your blog posts is certainly a method for learning. We can certainly get into that right away, because that's one of the questions that I love to ask, especially OSINT people, because like you said, there really haven't been great ways for learning it. And I think you already referenced that you just kind of taught yourself. And I'm guessing you get that question a lot from students and people wanting to get into the OSINT field. How do I get into this? How do I start? How do I learn? What kind of advice do you give people with those questions?
Yeah, the OSINT field is strange because anybody can get into it, right? Like base level, you need a browser and no real special knowledge to get started. I do think there's a barrier. People that I have talked to that are trying to break in, they get nervous. They see all of these experts talking about all the tools they use. And it kind of becomes like, where do I start? There's all these tools. I can't possibly learn them all. I have no way to practice. I'm afraid to do something illegal or go somewhere I'm not supposed to go. And I don't know all these tools. How do I get started? The way I did was through volunteering. Trace Labs was a good one. And I know that's super popular right now. It gives you an opportunity to put a lot of the things you learn into practice in a safe way, because you're kind of doing it in a capture the flag game. You're looking for missing people, so there's a good OSINT for good aspect to it, and you're kind of policed as to what you need to provide. So you have a list, like find a name, find a address, so it kind of guides you along the way. But even still, I feel like a lot of it is teaching yourself, because like so many other jobs, especially in cybersecurity, there's a million ways you could go with it. Like, you could be a corporate intelligence analyst. You could be a maritime OSINT person, pen testing OSINT. Like, it's like all over the place. So first, you got to kind of figure out what you like to do. Do you like looking at maps all the time? Do you like looking at ships? Do you like, I don't know, ICS stuff? Those are all valid OSINT careers that you can get into. Once you figure out kind of what you want to do, find somebody who's doing it and then emulate what they're doing. Like, you don't have to copy them entirely, but if you like how they write blogs, if you like how they talk about things or they give presentations, it doesn't have to be just one person. You could like somebody for their presentations. You could like somebody for their blogging or how they do their work, and like mush that together into this person that you want to become and use that as a guide. Like along the way, that was kind of what I did. I found a bunch of people because I was so new to that. I had never heard of OSINT until you, Patrick, gave us tickets to the Layer 8 conference. And that's where I met Trace Labs. And I mean, I was new to cybersecurity, never heard of OSINT before, didn't know anything about the intelligence community or anything like that. And just kind of jumped in and learned everything I can and like modeled myself after other people.
Just amazing the work that you've done in the last 5 years or so. You touched on when people get started and they can get overwhelmed with tools. Now, what advice do you have for people with trying to learn tools versus trying to learn just kind of an OSINT methodology or mindset?
I think this is like a hotly debated topic in OSINT.
Great.
I'm not against tools. I am against the gatekeeping of doing a job because you don't know tools. Like, for instance, we played in Trace Labs, DEF CON 29, 30. I don't know what DEF CON we're at now, but, and my team won. One of the other teams, when we wrote our blog, our write-up of like how we found things, they were like, oh, they just use Google. Like, they didn't really win. They just use Google. And like, my argument is we still won. Like, it doesn't matter what you use. If you use Google and you find where the person is, what does it matter if you used a paid tool that, collects 5 million email addresses if you don't know where the person is? Like, easiest tool, I think, for the job. And don't get bogged down by tools. Like, I am constantly asked which tools I use, and it's not many. I am unfortunately a very manual searcher. I spend a lot of time in Google dorking, putting things in quotes in different ways. You can find a lot about what you're trying to find. That, and I'm also very visual, so I like making charts. And I find, especially with corporate recon stuff, if I make a big chart of the data I have, so kind of my setup here is I use OneNote, or you could use Google Drive or whatever, something where you can take notes. So I will, say I'm supposed to look into a company A. So I will make a OneNote. I'll dump everything into there that I can find. Just Google after Google after Google. Here's a person's name. Here's the connected company. And I'll do that for like an hour a day, something like that. I give myself a time limit. And then I switch over to a chart and I put it all in a chart and I look at it and then I look where all the gaps are. And then I do the Googling again, and maybe I'll hit the tools that I do have. Because, you know, some people have paid tools through their job or because they pay for them. Not necessary. There's plenty of free tools. Open Corporates, marine traffic is free to a point. Shipping stuff. There's plenty of free tools. And I just keep doing that over and over. And then I look at the gaps and I do it again and I do it again. And eventually it gets to a point where you've blown out their entire lives or the entire like state of their company. And, you know, that's what people want most of the time.
When you get to the point where you know the people better than their own families do sometimes. One of the things that I often wonder, and I've also been asked about too, is when you start digging down that rabbit hole, one of the things that we don't always know is whether that information is available or we just haven't dug far enough yet. How do you know when you've gone far enough down that rabbit hole and you need to back up and maybe try a different direction?
This is hard for me because I am somebody who really needs to find something. Mm-hmm. When I have a task, like figure out what these people are doing or this group is doing, I need to find something. But I will give myself a time limit. I mean, if the job itself doesn't give me a time limit, but even so, if the time limit is like, oh, you need to have all this done in 24 hours. So then I have to come up with time limits for myself. I'm only going to do Google searching for the first 2 hours. And then I'm going to switch to, I don't know, like this paid tool and see what I can find and then go back. So I break my time up very specifically.
Okay. That certainly makes sense. Now, the other thing that I really wanted to talk to you about is your book. You wrote a book on OSINT called Deep Dive, Exploring the Real World Value of Open Source Intelligence. Why did you decide to write a book?
It was a New Year's resolution. So every year I come up with a bunch of attainable goals. And then I'll pick one that just seems like super wild to me. Whether I hit it or not, it doesn't matter. But I like having that really crazy goal. You know, the first one was break into the industry or be known as an expert in OSINT.
Achieved.
So like, I feel like it pushes me along the way because I have the goal there, even if I don't expect to ever get it. So that was my goal. I don't know what time is, 2021, 22 is when I wrote it. Yeah. So I made that as a New Year's resolution. I reached out to somebody I knew had written a book with Wiley, and actually Philip Wiley, who I actually had an interview with when I was first starting in cybersecurity because I was reaching out to experts, and had a great talk with him about pen testing because I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into pen testing. And he was really great to talk to. But he had written a book for Wiley, and he hooked me up with somebody and they asked for a proposal. I wrote one pretty quick. I mean, like, honestly, I was like, oh, shit, I need a proposal. So I like, quick, come up with a proposal. Here's a template. And turned it in. They made no changes. And they're like, okay, write a book now. And then I was like, oh, I guess I got to figure out how to write a book now. So yeah, I literally had no idea how to write a book. I've written papers for school, but that's about it. So I knew it was going to be 500 some pages. I knew my timeline. So it was kind of broken up in that timeline, like do this many pages by this date. And I just cranked it out. My partner in Case Scenarios, Espen, he was like the technical editor. So we kind of went back and forth. I wrote stuff. He told me it sucked. I rewrote it. And here we are.
So who is the intended audience for the book? Is it like beginner friendly? Is it just pages of tools? Like, who is the book really for?
So I tried to write it for all levels. That being said, it is beginner focused. So it starts off with like easy stuff. What is OSINT? How do you perform OSINT? Those type of very beginner level stuff. And then I kind of handhold you through all of that stuff to where I break it down into the subjects. So looking for people, looking for transportation stuff, looking for systems. And then in each chapter, I tried to do, what are you looking for? Why are you looking for it? How do you look for it? And then any tools that I have, you know, I just throw out some tools that I use. But it's not a list of tools. I know some people like the lists of tools because they love tools. I, on the other hand, would rather have the methodology. I want to know why I'm doing it and then tell me how to do it. And then any tool will work for me, right? You can make anything work if you know the why behind it. And I think that that's missing a lot of the times is like, tell me why. Why would I go here to do this thing? Why would I want to find an email? What can I do with that? So that's what I was trying to fill there. But I go from very beginner level topics to what I think are intermediate level topics that are not covered in other books, like transportation. I don't know that that's in any other OSINT book I've read. Correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't read them all. But I tried to do some stuff that was mine, like something I am super interested in. In all honesty, I wanted to write a maritime book and they were like, maybe write an OSINT book, but put maritime in it. And I was like, okay, that's good enough.
Do you need to be technical to be an OSINT analyst? And if you were hiring for an analyst, what types of skills and qualities would you look for?
I don't think you need to be technical. And I do, I feel that from a lot of people, especially women. I hear that they are nervous, they're not technical enough because whatever reason they see all these tools, or people say you have to know Python and all that. I don't know Python. I don't know. God help me if I have to script anything. I do think that you can teach someone how to be technical. You cannot teach someone to be creative. You cannot teach someone to want to dig into something. Like if I get a problem, if somebody says, I got this weird text or this weird person emailed me, or I think this is a scam. Like the first thing I think is I'm going to go home and I'm going to look into this person. Doesn't matter if it's for anything, if I'm being paid or free or whatever, I have to dig just to know. And I don't think you can teach someone that. So to me, that is the most valuable quality. If I was hiring someone, I'd rather feel their passion for it, their want to know more, to dig into things, than, you know, whether you can script things or, I mean, obviously, like some technical skills are useful. You might have to learn those on the job, but you can be taught those.
Now, in the book, you also talk a little bit about the value of critical thinking. Where does that come into OSINT, the value of critical thinking?
I mean, I think it's most of OSINT, right? Because you have to look at everything you find critically. You get a name, they're connected to somebody else. You have to think about, you know, are they friends? Why are they friends with this person? Or is it a drug relationship? Is it like, there's so many different avenues you can go down when you're investigating anything, that if you don't have that skill for critical thinking and you just take things at face value, you're never going to uncover what the good stuff. Like it'll always be hidden from you.
Yeah, I think that probably also falls a little bit more into what you were saying about really needing to understand the tools, because there can be the perfect tool that gets created. You really love this tool, and then all of a sudden it stops working. It's not supported anymore. And if you don't understand the why and the how and all that behind it, because I don't know if this is 100% true, but it seems like for so many OSINT tools, it's true for a lot of them, that really they're just kind of wrappers for proper Google searching anyway.
Yes.
So it really does seem like if you can really get good at your own, whatever search engine is your favorite searching, then the tools really just kind of make things easier for you. Is that all something that you might?
Yeah, I think it's a quickness. Like if you learn to use the tools, you can get things quicker. I think where the hang up is, is people use the tools to gather mass information. And then you end up with this folder of 5 million email addresses. And like, what do you do with that? There's no intelligence to be had there. You have a lot of email addresses. Now, what does that mean to me? When, you know, if person A does that and person B goes and does 3 Google searches and finds out, oh, this person robbed this bank or whatever, like that is much more quality information than having a pile of email addresses.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people starting out doing OSINT really need to learn is the difference between just data and intelligence. How do you see the difference between just what is data and what is going to be intelligence in the OSINT?
Yeah, I mean, you can collect all the data you want. The intelligence comes from making that data into something. So if I have an email address, what does that mean? Like, cool, you can put in a report, I found this email address, but wouldn't it be better to say, I found this email address, it is tied to this criminal, and they did this transaction on this date, which means this. Like, that is intelligence to me. Just having the data means nothing. And that's all report writing too, right? Which is also a big gap in our industry, is there's not a lot of ways to learn how to write reports. And So people learn OSINT and they get all this information and they're like, I don't know what to do with all this stuff. I have so much of it. So for me, and I am a very manual searcher, and I know it drives some people crazy, but I'm also very fast. I would rather do a million Google searches than sift through the data that comes from a tool. Like I said before, my method would be targeted Google searching over and over again. And then if I get stuck, maybe I'll go to, you know, a people search tool or something, get some more social media. But I will die on this hill. Google is probably my number one tool.
And I also like one of those pieces that you kind of referenced in there, because it's advice that I've also given to people starting out, not just in the OSINT field, but also in the information security field. If I were to ever have somebody come to me and say, I have good communication skills, I know how to write a report, that would be somebody that goes right to the top of my list. Because all too often we get people, like in my field, in like in pen testing, people would be like, I know how to do this hack, I can do these kinds of hacks as well. It's like, okay, that's great. But can you explain this to somebody in the C-suite? Can you write a report?
Can you tell it to a CEO?
Right. That seems to be one of the most undervalued skills that people have. And I think if people were to focus on building up that skill along with their OSINT searching skills, their technical skills, anything else like that, that's going to really move somebody to that top of the hiring list.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is something that a lot of people struggle with, and there's no real way to practice it. Right? Like, unless you're at a job and you're already in it and they're like, make a report, and you're like, oh, okay. And then you struggle through it and that's the way you learn it. But wouldn't it be better to learn it ahead of time?
Absolutely.
If only someone was creating something that could help you.
Oh, do you think that you know of somebody that has created something like that that might be able to help investigate cases?
I do. I do. And that was not an intentional plug, by the way. So, yes, I've been working in this immersive OSINT training company called Case Scenarios that my technical editor from the book and I, Espen, have been working on for a little over a year. I think we hit a year in December. So we have a few scenarios out, and the idea is that when you're learning OSINT, you need hands-on work. You can't just, you know, you start a job, you learn on the job, but that's not ideal, right? It's best to know before you start a job, like, what you're doing. And even if you take a certification, like, they're great. A lot of them are expensive. You're sitting in a room for a week. You're getting great training, but not a lot of it is hands-on. And then maybe you have a test at the end. It's a report or something. You've never learned how to write a report. And now you're struggling to like win the coin or whatever you get at the end. So a lot of our scenarios are based on topics. So journalism, crime solving, kind of investigative OSINT. And our goal is to have a scenario for every kind of career that would be in OSINT. We have four or five scenarios out. Don't quote me on that. We're putting out a new one that we're beta testing right now, and it's going to be a report style scenario. So instead of the typical immersive experience, so unlike another capture the flag, you would go to our scenario and it would be like you're working for somebody. So, you know, your boss, Patrick, has asked you to do this task, and then we'll give you hints. You'll go do whatever you have to do, and then you come back and input the answer in a box, kind of like a CTF. But the difference is the, you know, immersiveness. So we're trying to make it feel real, like you are the person in the story, which has been great. We've gotten great feedback. But now we're switching it up a little bit. And on top of that, we're going to do report style scenarios. So you will still get a task from a boss, a stakeholder of some sort. They will give you something to do. You will go out now into the real world because there'll be real people, real companies, real stuff you're looking at, like really out there. And then we'll ask you to write a report for your boss. So you'll sit down with our template that we've created. You'll write a report and then you'll turn it into your senior analyst, which, you know, senior analyst, which will be us, and we will review it. And then the senior analyst will come back and tell you, you know, change this, adjust this, see what you did here, you know, maybe do something better. Then you'll rewrite it and you'll submit it to your boss, and then you'll get, you know, a pass. There's no points. It's all just pass fail kind of, you know, redo it. We don't want anybody to like, it's not a points game. It's not a win or lose. It's a learning process. And this is meant to fill the large gap of not knowing how to write reports. And a lot of the people who take our scenarios are students in colleges, and they might run it during their semester. And then at the end, they're giving them a test anyway. They're making them write a report. So we're just like filling that gap as well, like hoping that this helps people learn how to write reports better before they take a certification that might make you write a report at the end, or before you get a job, or even if you're hiring people and you want to make them do it as like a test to see if somebody can write a report before you hire them.
And I would think if somebody wants to be an OSINT investigator, get a job somewhere doing OSINT, that report that they write as part of your investigations is something they could hand over with their application. And this would be something that I would think hiring managers would love to see.
Yeah, and they'll get a badge. Like, everybody loves digital badges.
Gotta love badges.
You'll get a digital badge. But yeah, I think I'm hoping that people really like it. I know even for myself, I had never written a report, an intelligence report, before I started at my job. So it would have been nice to have some sort of training ahead of that.
And where does somebody go to get started with case scenarios?
You go to casescenarios.com, and we have all of our present scenarios are up there. We have a free one that you can try out called Betrayal. That's it's like a crime one, and bonus points if you can tell me which crimes they are mimicking, because I'm a true crime person. And then we have like a journalist one, and we have a few other, a missing person one. They're all very cool. I do the graphics for them, so I hope people like them. I mean, so far we've gotten really good reviews.
And we can certainly put the link to that in the show notes, but just to make sure people understand, it's KASE scenarios.
Yes. Excellent. KASE scenarios.com.
So we can make sure that people find that properly.
Yes, we're cool. We made it a K.
So it stands out.
Right.
Now, one of the other things that comes up from time to time in OSINT, and I've talked to other people about this as well, is the issues with biases. And one of the things that I remember hearing Michael Bazell talk about as well is understanding that just because you find one piece of information about your target, that doesn't necessarily make it true.
Yeah.
Is that something that you also deal with in terms of needing to confirm the information that you find somehow.
Yeah, I think everybody has some sort of bias, whether they're aware of it or not. So it is always good to constantly check yourself, especially when you might be investigating something political or something religious, or, you know, who knows, it comes up all the time. To check yourself and then verify what you're seeing, and even maybe send it to somebody else and say, you know, does this seem right? Is this, am I looking at this the right way? Because everybody puts things into other people's mouths and kind of comes up with their own conclusions. And it's really hard to turn that off sometimes. If something you're passionate about, I think it's always good to constantly remind yourself.
And that's also got to be hard when you're doing investigations for law enforcement, where if your bias comes into play there, you could put somebody in jail who might not have done something just because of the way that you frame your case.
And I'm sure it happens. I mean, we know it happens. So the best you can do is just constantly keep that in mind when you're doing work, that to do the best job you can do, you have to remain impartial and not take a side and just look at the data for what the data is.
Yeah, I think sometimes the best feedback that I've gotten in the past when I've done OSINT and written up reports, we did hand them off to other people to do like a quality assurance and all that kind of check on. And there were so many times when I first started, they would point out various things that I had found and I thought proven with just a big, how do you know that? I think it's the line from A Few Good Men of don't tell me what you know, tell me what you can prove, which seems to be super important in OSINT.
Yeah, and it's very hard when you're researching and then you're writing a report and you've put in so many hours into it and you've come to a conclusion and you want people to like believe that conclusion, that you get to a point where you don't want to like step back and say maybe I'm wrong. So it's always good to be reminded and work with somebody else if you can. Like you said, you have a person who checks it. That's good to have, I think.
You also mentioned that you are a private investigator. How does somebody do that? I've always thought that's kind of interesting on the process of becoming a private investigator. And is it as cool as just kind of following people around town all night long?
Yes, it's super cool. I sit in my car and I
drink coffee.
I hunt people. I have never done any actual private. I got it because I thought it would be cool to be able to say I was a private investigator. In Alabama, it's very easy. In Pennsylvania, it is very hard. And that's where I came from. And I always wanted to be a private investigator, but it was like you have to shadow somebody for 6 months or something. Some states make it very easy. Like you just take a test and they're like, stamp of approval. You can go out and surveil someone.
Can you spell private investigator?
Exactly.
Does getting that then unlock additional resources for you that other people who don't have that certification can have?
It does. It gives you access to some databases. You still have to pay for them. But you get access to them with your credentials. I could surveil someone in my car if I wanted to. You get put on like a website where people can contact you if they have any jobs they want you to do. But other than that, other than networking, and it's more just the cool badge for me anyway.
So if people do have jobs that they're looking for or need information on somebody, is that something that you can do as well? Can people approach you and say, hey, can you find out information about this situation?
In my state, yeah. In the state and the neighboring states.
So yeah. You mentioned earlier that you also have your New Year's resolutions. Do you have any kind of great goals for this year that you want to tell anybody about? Anything that you're looking forward to doing? What is next for you?
This year was hard. This year was hard. What do you do after you write a book?
You write the next edition.
And I tried, and they're like, just wait to see how sales are. I was like, I'm ready to write another one. No, I thought a lot. What I really want is I want a Netflix show. I want someone to pay attention to me and put my stuff on TV, which is ridiculous. But as a true crime aficionado, I would call myself, that would be like the pinnacle of cool to me, to have like my own Netflix series or short film or something.
So I know you give conference presentations, you attend conferences, you jump into some of the CTFs. Do you have anything like that coming up or anything recently that you've done that people can see?
I have been laying low on conferences for a while because I went hard. I went hard from like 2019 to like last year, hitting as many as I could. So I kind of stepped back on those a little. I do some virtual ones because they're easier. But most of what I've been doing now is working on case stuff. So putting out new scenarios, I do all the graphics and videos for that. And then we collaborate on the scenarios themselves. So that's quite a lot of work for like 2.5 people.
This has been a whole lot of fun. I've again really enjoyed this conversation with you. So I just wanted to say thank you for joining. Thanks for being here on the Layer 8 podcast, Ray Baker.
Yeah, thank you for having me back again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Layer 8 podcast. Check back every 2 weeks for a new episode talking about OSINT and social engineering. If you have pen test or social engineering needs, Compass CyberGuard can help. Get more information by emailing info@layer8podcast.org.